readers, welcome to the Book Report. The holidays, family and friends, dinner and drinks, parties and get-togethers. Phew! I love being busy and seeing scads of people. But sometimes a bit of alone time is mighty appealing these days. My RX for retaining a modicum of sanity during the holidays is to seek out the company of a great book. And that's where the Book Report comes in. Great titles and guests to discover together today. So, right in this saint nick of time, we'll turn to page one of the Book Report.
Traditional advertising can be expensive and wasteful. But lately, you've been hearing a lot about social media and viral marketing. But let's be honest, it's confusing. That's why you need Magic Buzz, a new marketing company so unique, we've even coined a special phrase for what we do. Socio-viral. We combine the word-of-mouth friendliness of social media, like Facebook, Twitter, together with the viral reach power of YouTube, to create the socio-viral effect. The Magic Buzz team makes sure our clients are well represented online. We recently took word-of-mouth advertising to the number one position as most productive medium for a major cell phone company. That's right. Magic Buzz produced more sales than an expensive TV campaign at a fraction of the cost. Put the power of socio-viral marketing to work for you. Visit us at magicbuzz.com. M-A-G-I-C-B-U-Z.com. If you have any questions, please feel free to email us at info@magicbuzz.com. Magic Buzz. We're there when you can't be.
Okay, this one was a little hard for me to believe, but Glenn Beck, yes, you heard me correctly, Glenn Beck has written a novel that readers are calling heartwarming. The Snow Angel tells the tale of Rachel Price, a woman with a beloved childhood memory, that of playing outside with her dad, Mitch, on a cold and snowy day. In that moment, he took her hands in his and called her his angel. She felt safe, loved, and protected. Tragically, several years later, Rachel's mother was killed in a car crash. Her father's reaction to certain realities surrounding the death pushes Rachel away. She begins to believe her dad never truly loved her. Years later, Rachel's own daughter, Lily, is the only light in her dark life. Rachel is trapped in an abusive marriage, but too afraid to escape. On Christmas Eve, Rachel's husband raises a hand to Lily in a moment of aggression that finally snaps Rachel out of her docile state. She realizes she must protect her daughter. Through the help of an old friend, Rachel has a safe place to go, but first, she must say goodbye to her father. As the snow falls on Christmas Eve, Rachel learns it's never too late to start over. The Snow Angel is a tale about family, forgiveness, and learning to treasure our memories while allowing ourselves to move forward. January Lavoie and Ron McLarty narrate.
Lily gave me a withering look and snapped a tight crease in the towel she was folding. I watched my daughter add the neat hand towel to the growing pile of clean laundry and found myself marveling again at the graceful curve of her neck, the spark in her denim blue eyes. Lily was a wonder, smart and beautiful and spunky, but she was also wrong. If I followed through with our secret plan, Cyrus might very well kill me. "He's going to be furious," I said. Lily shrugged.
"So? Stand up to him, Mom. What's the worst that could happen?"
I could think of a dozen different scenarios, and none of them were pleasant. But what did my 11-year-old daughter know about the complexity of a sad and loveless marriage? How could I expect her to understand the give and take of my relationship with her father? I gave, Cyrus took. It was a simple equation, one that I knew by heart.
"It's complicated, sweetie."
I tucked the final washcloth into a square and began loading the piles of linens into the laundry basket for distribution throughout the four bathrooms in our palatial house. We had more bathrooms than family members, but I considered the sprawl of our ungainly residence a blessing. It gave me many places to hide. Guest rooms and dark hallways, sometimes closets. But Lily didn't know about any of that. Cyrus and I only fought when our daughter was asleep, and though our confrontations usually consisted of nothing more than vicious words and savage insults, I couldn't stand the thought of her hearing the ugly things her father said to me. I had vowed long ago that Lily would never suffer the truth of my messed up marriage, and I had kept my promise. I drew Cyrus away, made sure that there was never a reason for his anger to light upon our daughter. It worked. I was an exemplary lightning rod.
Well,
Lily put her hands on her narrow hips and arched her eyebrows at me.
I think you have to do it. Mr. Weaver needs you. How can you say no?
I can't say no, I sighed. I'll do it. But you have to promise me that you won't let it slip to Dad. It's our secret, right? Lily crossed her heart with a slender finger and fixed me with an impish grin. She was mature for her age, but the glint in her eye reminded me that my daughter was still a little girl, and one who thrilled at the mere thought of a secret. It struck me that her enthusiasm for my short-term assistance in Max Weaver's tailor shop had more to do with the promise of intrigue than a selfless desire to help an elderly man in need. My heart broke a little at her unblemished view of life. Lily still believed in innocent secrets, the heady rush of a good mystery, and happily ever after. I wasn't about to disabuse her of those sweet notions. Little girls should be allowed to dream. You're going to miss the bus, I said, hoisting the laundry basket into my arms. I leaned forward and kissed the cheek that Lily proffered. Remember, I want you to come straight to Eden after school. Lily giggled.
That sounds so silly.
She affected what I assumed to be a bad impersonation of my voice.
Come to paradise after school, Lily.
She dropped the phony inflection.
I can't believe Mr. Weaver named his tailor shop Eden Custom Tailoring.
It was my idea, I said. A long time ago. A lifetime ago.
Subtle,
Lily joked. How do you even know what subtle means? I shook my head at her. Be serious. I want you to come straight to the shop. But don't take the bus there, okay? Get off at your regular stop and then walk.
Should I duck behind trees?
Lily struck a Charlie's Angel pose.
Double back to make sure no one is following me?
Now you're being melodramatic. I pursed my lips and tried not to regret my decision too much. Just try to keep this under wraps, please. You have to believe me, Lil. Your dad would not be happy if he knew that I was going to help Max. He likes me home, you know that.
I know.
Lily grabbed her backpack off the table and slung it over her shoulders.
I'm a good secret keeper.
You're not the only one, I thought. And before I could further expound on the covert nature of my temporary appointment at Eden Custom Tailoring, Lily flounced out of the room. I heard the tap of her light footsteps in the entryway, and then the slam of the front door. It seemed symbolic to me, a final drumbeat that echoed through our cavernous house with finality, that signified an end.
That was The Snow Angel by Glenn Beck.
William Kennedy was born in 1928 in Albany, New York, a town immortalized in many of his novels. Kennedy's Albany cycle includes Legs, Billy Phelan's Greatest Game, Ironweed, winner of the 1984 Pulitzer Prize for Fiction, and the National Book Critics Circle Award, Quinn's Book, Very Old Bones, The Flaming Corsage, and Roscoe. Booklist describes his newest work, Chongo's Beads and Two-Tone Shoes, as a jazzy, seductive, historically anchored novel of politics and romance, race and revolution. After serving in the Army, Kennedy lived in Puerto Rico, where he met his mentor, Saul Bellow. While living in San Juan, he befriended journalist-author Hunter Thompson, a friendship that continued throughout their careers. Kennedy worked for the Albany Times-Union as an investigative journalist, writing stories exposing activities of the O'Connell political machine there. Often called the Bard of Albany, Kennedy uses his hometown as the setting for 8 of his novels. Book critic Jonathan Yardley states that Kennedy has painted a portrait of a single city, perhaps unique in American fiction. Welcome, William. Thanks for stopping by the Book Report.
Well, I'm very happy to be here. It's my first time at the book fair.
The cast of characters in your new book is staggering. Bing Crosby, Hemingway, Fidel, priests and provocateurs. How did you assemble this literary gang?
Well, Crosby made a record a long time ago with the Mills Brothers called Shine, and I was determined to put that into a novel for the last 15 years. And so I finally figured it out that I wrote the scene, which is the opening scene of the novel, Crosby, 1936. And I've been a Crosby fan for all my life, but these records that he made with the Mills Brothers in 1931 are just extremely fantastically great. This book is about, in large part, about the civil rights movement in the 60s. It takes place, second half of the book takes place in 1968, on the day Bobby Kennedy is shot, June the 5th. And during about 12 hours, and the city is in great ferment, and there's rioting of some small order, and then becomes worse as the day goes on. And then there's racial tensions and other dimensions of activist priest has been silenced, and things are in an uproar. Also, it has Fidel, because I worked in Miami here in 1957 on the Miami Herald. I was a reporter. My beat was Cuba. And Cubans in Miami, not down in Cuba. We didn't have anybody stationed there. People came and went. But it was a great time. And then Fidel was already at this time up in the hills. And Quinn, my main character, Daniel Quinn, who has a career somewhat parallel to my own. He worked in the Herald, and then he quits and goes to Cuba. And in a sense, I did that, but not really. I went to Cuba much later and several times, but I was in Puerto Rico for a number of years, and I was very close to what was happening in Cuba. And anyway, the young man meets Hemingway in the bar the first night he's in Cuba. Or the first three nights he's in Cuba. Third night he finally meets Hemingway. And he also runs into this beautiful girl who's with her brother-in-law. And he falls instantly in love with her and follows up the next day. And she is a part of the rebellion that's going to try and kill Batista. She's a gun runner and she's a debutante. And wealthy and intelligent, and her name is Renata, and Quinn pursues her, and their love story begins with a bang right away, you know, and it follows the whole novel.
How did you choose the title?
Well, part of Renata, the beauty, the gun running beauty, is. A follower of the Santeria religion. She's raised Catholic, but as in many people in Cuba, and not overwhelmingly many, but many, they do practice Santeria. It's basically a religion that came from the slaves from Africa, and was over the centuries it was blended with Catholicism to make it more acceptable to the Spanish colonial. Slave owners, and so they didn't think that this religion was a form of revolution by the slaves. So they fused the two religions, a syncretic religion, with these two religions taken together. And one in the Santeria religion are what they call orishas. There's 4 or 5 dozen of them, and one of them is Xangô. Who is a great warrior and a womanizer and in control of lightning and thunder. And he's a great presence and a great, he's the most popular of the Orishas, and in especially in Havana. And so I came across him and I decided to use him. And I was given a set of beads, Shango's beads, as a kind of good luck thing, and he's represented by red and white beads. And I had those beads, and I had to figure I should use them. played out like a rosary I used to have when I was a kid, and I used that in another novel. But the beads became an artifact of the theme of rebellion and war and trying to achieve your goals and happiness in this life. And so Sean goes beads, and they were an element. And somebody said, well, you should, my researcher said, you should call the book Sean Goes Beads. Well, I said, that only cuts half the mustard, you know? And then I said, I know, yeah, two-tone shoes. Because the two-tone shoes, I had them when I was a kid. I haven't seen them lately. But they're like wingtips, and they're brown and white or black and white. And that's what one of my characters in Albany during the 1968 city uprising, and he's a black wino named Tremont Van Ort, and he's a terrific guy, and he's a drunk, and he's very tough and very lost, and he becomes a principal figure because he's a pawn in a political move to discredit some of the black movements in the city that are speaking out against the status quo and against the politicians.
Now, you've been called the Bard of Albany, and I know that your house that you currently live in has a big history. Tell us about that for a moment.
Well, I have two houses, but one house in Albany is notable because it's the place where the gangster Jack Legs Diamond was murdered in December 14th, 17th, I'm not sure, 1931. And it's we were going to make a movie of my novel Legs, in which Jack Diamond is the principal character, and he was very famous in the East. He was the most famous gangster of the 20s in the East, and he moved to Albany to live during the last year of his life or so, the better part of it. And he lived down in the Catskill Mountains, and he kept coming to Albany all the time. He was very well known. He was in the papers every day, and he was a huge, he was like a rock star, a movie star would be today. And he was there after he had been acquitted in December 1931 of a kidnapping and torturing a truck driver who wouldn't tell him where he was going with 27 barrels of cider, hard cider. And the fellow went in to get a pistol permit and told the police that Diamond had tortured him, and that broke Diamond's empire. And the governor at the time was Franklin D. Roosevelt, and he was on his way to the White House. This is 1931, and he gets elected in 32. But so he sent the troops in. He sent the state police and the Attorney General, and they just wiped that Diamond's empire off the face of the Catskills. And he was dealing in 18 counties. He was a big, big gangster in the Prohibition era. And then he was told to stay out of Albany, but he came back, and he took up a couple of rooms for his wife and his sister-in-law and her kid. So, who were with him at the trial in Troy, New York, and he went back there after the party. He was drunk, and the two guys came in and told him that he was supposed to not come back to Albany, and they put three bullets in his head, and that was the end of Jack Diamond. The room where they did that is now my office.
Haunted.
I used to have a lamp that went on and off, and people thought it was Jack saying hello.
Well, thanks so much for stopping by today. It's been a pleasure speaking with you.
And now, let's hear a sample from Chango's Beads and Two-Tone Shoes, narrated by the author.
Bing and I go back a couple of years in Saratoga, Alex said. My father bred thoroughbreds, and Bing bought one of them. Bing, not Bingo. A nice horse, Bing said, not swift. Quinn knew Bing from the radio.
Bing Crosby is really singing right here. A party. You are with Paul Whiteman, George Quinn said.
My traveling days, Bing said.
Whiteman got my brother-in-law fired from Riley's, George said. Billy Phelan. Billy was dealing at the crap table and Whiteman asked him for 500 cash for an IOU. He called Billy Sonny. Give me 500, Sonny. Billy wouldn't give it to him, and Whiteman said, You know who I am? And Billy said, Yeah, you're the guy with that hillbilly band playing over at Piping Rock.
Big Paul loved that, Bing said.
They fired Billy.
Too bad, Bing said. He had a good ear for hillbillies.
Music, Cody. We need music, Alex said. Cody carried a chair to the piano and sat down. He hit a chord, and Bing sang a note and held it. He sang some words.
Just because my hair is curly, just because my teeth are pearly.
Quinn looked at the five men, trying to understand this gathering. He jounced down a few steps. Bing sang,
Just because my color's shady.
Then Cody sang,
Use a shady baby.
Then Cody and Bing sang together.
That's the reason, maybe, why they call me Shine.
Cody saw Quinn at the foot of the stairs and stopped playing.
Hey, whose little man are you?
That's Danny, my little man, George said. He's had to follow me around all day and all night. Peg had some work in Atlantic City.
Come on, join the party, Dan, Cody said.
Quinn walked to his father, who put his arm around the boy's head and squeezed.
Howdy, Dan, Bing said.
He offered Danny a handshake. Quinn shook hands and looked at all the men he only half knew. What were they doing?
You're Bing, he said.
Hey, you been following me? You been tapping my telephone?
I heard you on the radio.
Can't deny it. I've been on the radio.
He stays up till your show is over, George said.
The boy will go far, Bing said. Quinn looked at Cody and thought he should also shake hands with him.
You're going to stay in the guest house, Quinn said.
You got a lot of information on people, Cody said.
I like that song, Quinn said.
Shine. What's that?
Nobody answered him.
Shine, Alex said, like a shine on your shoes.
Or shine on Harvest Moon, Bing said.
Like the thing at the end of our kitchen light string, George said. It shines in the dark.
Shine's a song, Cody said. Bing recorded it with the Mills Brothers. You ever heard of the Mills Brothers?
No, Quinn said.
Well, you should, Cody said. Get your daddy to buy you their records.
Very great singers, Bing said.
Shine isn't just a song, Cody said.
No, said Bing. It's an insult. A bad word, but a great song.
The song turns the insult inside out.
What insult? Quinn asked.
I'll tell you later, George said.
I got a boy like you, Cody said. He's 3. How old are you, Danny?
8.
My boy's got 5 years to catch you.
Is he coming here tonight? Quinn asked.
No, he's with his mama.
What's his name? Quinn asked.
Roy. He's a shine, like me.
You're a shine? Quinn asked.
Oh, yeah.
I'll tell you about it in the morning, George said.
Can you sing the song again? Quinn asked.
Sure can, Bing said.
And now, let's hear a sample from Tengol's Beads and Two-Tone Shoes, narrated by the author. And so, dear readers, next we'll unwrap Out of Oz, The Wicked Years by Gregory Maguire, the conclusion to the best-selling Wicked series. All right, I loved Wicked. I read the book. I saw the play. I loved Mirror, Mirror, Maguire's Cinderella tale. I can't tell you how excited I was to begin this title. But
I went along page after page, page after page, page after page, and began to ask myself, where's the story? I started checking the reader reviews. They are, for the most part, positive, but there are some who agree with me by asking, where's the story? Slog, slog, page after page, detail, detail, detail. Then a storyline appears to keep you a bit intrigued, and then page after page of endless detail. At any rate, the story, once you find it, emerges like this. Once peaceful and prosperous, the land of Oz is knotted with social unrest. The Emerald City is mounting an invasion of Munchkinland. Glinda is under house arrest, and the Cowardly Lion is on the lam from the law. And look who's back! This time the victim of an earthquake. The one, the only, Dorothy. And have you ever thought about her last name for one little moment? Dorothy Gale, as in storm? I digress. Amid all this chaos, Elphaba's granddaughter, the tiny green baby born at the close of Son of a Witch, has come of age. Now it's up to Rain to take up her broom and her legacy in war-torn Oz. Readers, I admit, fantasy is not my number one pick, but I tried, I really tried. See what you think. John McDonough narrates.
Her consort, Pastorius, becomes Ozma regent during the minority of Ozma Tipitarius. Pastorius rules over central Oz. The Ozma regent renames the hamlet known as Nubbly Meadows, near the ancient burial ground of open tombs, as the Emerald City, E.C. Declares the E.C. as the capital of United Oz. The Great Drought begins. By balloon, Oscar Zoroaster Diggs arrives in the Emerald City. Diggs successfully mounts a palace coup d'etat. Pastorius is murdered, and the infant Ozma Tipitarius disappears. She is presumed slain, perhaps in Southstairs prison, built over the open tombs. Though an evergreen rumor claims she lies enchanted in a cave, awaiting her return at Oz's darkest hour. Diggs becomes known as the Wizard of Oz. The Wizardic Years. The Emerald City renovation is completed. The Wizard of Oz orders construction of the Yellow Brick Road. This serves as a highway for the armies of the EC and aids in the collection of local taxes from previously independent populations, especially in Quadling country and on the eastern flanks of the great kells of the Vincus. Animal adverse laws enacted. The Animal Courtesy Acts. Social unrest deriving from the Great Drought promotes an atmosphere of scapegoating and hysterical patriotism. Munchkinland secedes from loyal Oz. Under the rule of Nesseroes Throp, eminence of Munchkinland, the secession of the Free State of Munchkinland is conducted with a minimum of bloodshed. The breadbasket of Oz maintains an uneasy trade relationship with loyal Oz. Nesseroes Throp dies. The arrival in Oz of a visitor, a Dorothy Gale of Kansas, sometimes transcribed as Kansas or Kansas, results in the death of the eminence. Though rumor suggests her sister Elphaba Throp will return to Munchkinland to mount a more aggressive campaign against the EC than Nesseroes ever did, such predictions prove baseless. Elphaba Throp is vanquished. The so-called Wicked Witch of the West, one-time agitator, now recluse, is subdued by the powerful Dorothy Gale. The Wizard of Oz abdicates the throne. The wizard has held power for almost 40 years. The causes of his departure remain a matter of speculation. The Twin Interregnums. Lady Glinda Chaffrey, née Upland, is briefly installed as Throne Minister. The animal adverse laws are revoked to little effect. Animals remain sceptical of their chances of being reintegrated into human society in Oz. Many refuse to return to loyal Oz from Munchkinland, where they have taken refuge. The Scarecrow replaces Glinda as Throne Minister. The Scarecrow, a figure of uncertain provenance, is often assumed to have been installed as Throne Minister by palace apparatchiks sympathetic to Shell Throp, the youngest of the three Throp siblings. The Scarecrow proves a weak figurehead, a straw man, figuratively as well as literally, though his elevation allows Shell Throp to avoid having to challenge the popular Lady Glinda for the leadership. The Scarecrow's whereabouts following the end of his abbreviated realm are never revealed.
That was Out of Oz by Gregory Maguire. Heartwarming tale for the holiday season, Lost December by Richard Paul Evans is a modern-day Christmas-themed retelling of The Prodigal Son. When Luke graduates from Wharton with his MBA, his father, CEO and co-founder of a Fortune 500 company, is ready to share some good news. He wants to turn the family business over to his son. But Luke has other plans. Taking control of his trust funds, Luke leaves home to pursue a life of wanton pleasure-seeking. But when his funds run out, so do his friends. Humbled and alone, Luke takes a job at one of his father's copy centers. There he falls in love with a single mother and begins to understand the greatest source of personal joy. John Dossett narrates.
Some mistakenly believe that prodigal means lost or wayward. It doesn't. It means wastefully extravagant. No matter. Both definitions are true of me. Luke Crisp's diary. My seventh grade English teacher, Mr. Adams, used to say, "No matter how thin the pancake, there are still two sides. Two sides to every story." People mistake that little chestnut for wisdom, as if all real evil in this world can be explained away if we'll but listen to the other side of the story. Tell that to your local serial killer. I believe that adage amounts to nothing more than moral laziness. A motto for people who carry moral compasses without needles. Make no mistake, all evil has its side of the story. I'm telling you this because, in presenting my side of the story, I do not want you to confuse it for justification. No matter what excuses I told myself at the time, my choices were wrong. I was wrong. I'll warn you in advance, as you hear my story, you won't like me. I understand. Neither did I. You have likely heard the story of the prodigal son. That's my story, too. I'm here to tell my side of the story. Chapter 2. Only those who never step, never stumble. Luke Crisp's diary. If the seeds of my fall were planted in my youth, they didn't begin to bloom until my years at Wharton Business School at the University of Pennsylvania, carefully cultivated by a gardener you'll learn about later. Before then, I lived where I was born, in Scottsdale, Arizona, an upscale suburb of Phoenix. My childhood was a little unusual. My mother died of breast cancer when I was 7, and my father threw himself into his work to deal with his grief. My father, Carl Crisp, was an innovative and brilliant man, a corporate visionary. Through his industry, he built an international company. Unless you live in an Appalachian cave or a shanty in an Everglades swamp, you've probably heard of it, Crisp's Copy Centers. There are currently more than 2,000 locations throughout the U.S. and Canada, the number of stores rising monthly. My father threw himself into his work, but he didn't neglect me. Rather, he took me with him. I spent my early years at his side. When most boys my age were learning to throw a curveball, I was learning how to replace a toner cartridge in a color copier. By the time I was 16, I was managing my first copy center, a small, crisp copy shop in Gilbert, Arizona.
That was Last December by Richard Paul Evans. Another book with Robert Kennedy at its core is The Train of Small Mercies. My guest, David Rowell, is an editor at the Washington Post magazine and has taught literary journalism at American University. His short stories have been published in several anthologies. His debut novel, The Train of Small Mercies, is receiving strong reviews. Through a series of stories unfolding on a single day, the book provides a memorable snapshot of America at a crucial moment in our history. The day is June 8, 1968, a Saturday when the body of U.S. Senator Robert F. Kennedy is carried by train from New York City to Washington for burial at Arlington National Cemetery. Hundreds of thousands line the route to pay homage to the presidential candidate. Rowell recreates the day through vivid portraits and a range of characters, black and white, young and old, whose mostly humdrum and ordinary lives turn on events as they set out to watch the train pass. Each of their stories, told in staggered vignettes that begin in the morning, unfold in modest, commonplace settings, and revolve around familiar hopes, fears, schemes, and family dynamics. The period is captured in part by the constant offstage presence of the Kennedys, including the pregnant widow, Ethel Kennedy. As Rowell draws the reader into these lives, the novel becomes more than the sum of its stories. With a deft touch and an eye for telling detail, Rowell creates a memorable mosaic of America. Welcome, David. Thanks for joining us today.
Oh, thanks very much.
JFK, Martin Luther King, then RFK. I myself was just a kid then, but even my friends at our very young age were terrified that the assassinations would just keep on happening and who would be next. How do you address this national fear in the book?
Well, I think that the characters in the book are definitely overwhelmed with grief and confusion. I mean, you're right, it's just 5 years in which the country's three most prominent leaders, at least of the decade, have all been gunned down. And I think there's just some real confusion about how the country can go forward if everyone who steps up for, you know, the people in the country is going to be killed. So they're not completely without hope, these characters that I've written about, but there is a tremendous amount of despair.
Yeah, your book intertwines six different stories. How did you select the characters?
Well, the characters, the novel is really a kind of a fictional response to a book of photographs called RFK Funeral Train by Paul Fusco. And I've been studying this book just as an admirer for years, and so when I decided that I wanted to write a novel, I decided that I would write about these characters and let all the details, to the extent that was possible, let the details really come from the people in these pictures. I mean, ultimately it was going to be, you know, as any novel is, a work of imagination, but I wanted the foundation for these stories to come from these people that I've been looking at for so many years.
Yeah. My mother actually saw the FDR funeral train. I mean, what a different mood in the country.
Right. People remember the FDR funeral train and the Lincoln funeral train in terms of historians, and those are the ones that we think of. Even though 2 million people turned up to the tracks on this day in June 8, 1968, mostly it's a forgotten moment of history, and I think a lot of people know a lot about John Kennedy, and you know, I think these days not a lot of people know a lot about Robert Kennedy. So as I was doing the research and writing about these characters who were very affected by this day, you know, it felt great to be reminding people, even though it's a novel, but reminding people what Robert Kennedy stood for and what his vision of America was.
Yeah. In your research for the book, you interviewed a Washington Post reporter who had actually been on the train. Can you share some stories he told you about that day?
Right. David Broder was one of the great American reporters ever, and the newspaper pieces that he had written about the funeral train were greatly helpful to me. I mean, he he made me understand how difficult an assignment it was for all reporters who were covering Robert Kennedy, in part because there was a real sense that Kennedy was not going to make it, that someone was going to stop him. And in fact, Kennedy had said at some point, "I think there are guns between me and the White House." And so that made for a very somber mood of the reporters. And so on this day, when they're on the funeral train, as crushed as they were, and as people who followed Kennedy were all over, there was also not a great sense of shock among reporters. So he was just really helpful in helping me understand how people felt that day. And also he gave me a lot of useful details about the train itself. Not a lot has been written about the funeral train, and some of that information was hard to find. So having David here in the building was a great resource for me.
Well, which of the family members were actually on the train?
Well, let's see. Well, Ethel, certainly. And Ethel was pregnant with her 11th child at the time. And so all the children, as I understand it, were on the train. And certainly Ted Kennedy spent a fair amount of time at the very back of the train, basically on the caboose, waving to the crowds and thanking them, you know, as the train moved past through all these towns on the eastern seaboard.
Was Jackie Kennedy on the train?
I've never read that she was, but it's possible. I've just, she must have been. Yes, you know, she must have been, because she was certainly at the burial.
All right. Well, how can you compare America on the Robert Kennedy's assassination day with America on 9/11?
Well, there's certainly two different types of tragedies. I mean, there's a whole generation that has lived with this threat of terrorism. And, of course, that's its own difficult and awful experience. I think, though, there is a real difference, because back in the 60s, our leaders were literally gunned down. And I think that's just a reality that a lot of people can't, a younger generation can't quite conceive of them. And I think that the threat of terrorism, it's easier, I think, to go through the day-to-day and for that threat maybe to feel a little bit distant. But when your president has been killed, and then someone running for president has been killed, and then Martin Luther King, who was, you know, trying to unite all of America, were killed, I mean, I just think that's, I mean, it's hard to compare. It's hard to say one is more difficult than the other. But I think it's certainly true that this period, 1968, is certainly one of the most difficult times in U.S. history, and maybe second only to the Civil War. Because remember, after Martin Luther King is killed, there are, I think, 119 cities that are just destroyed in riots from coast to coast.
Well, you've been getting a lot of good reviews. So what are your what's your next writing project?
Well, the next novel is something entirely different. This novel was set in one day. The next novel was set in a week. Whereas the first novel has so many characters and so many stories going on, I'm going to do something quite different, which is the setting is a family beach trip in North Carolina, and so I have these six characters to focus on. And so there's something quite nice about having more space for, you know, fewer characters and really getting to do even more character development. So the second novel takes place in a week. If there's a third book, maybe it'll take place in a month. If there's a fourth book, a year, then maybe that will be it.
Do you have a working title for the second novel?
Well, I do. Right now I call it The Sound of Waves.
David, thanks so much. I have to say I really enjoyed your novel. It's a wonderful, poignant look at actually a terrible day in American history, but you made it really poignant. Thank you. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, thank you. Great to talk to you.
Alrighty, bye. From one of the most admired and beloved couples of our day comes an extraordinarily moving story of public service, risk-taking, and romance. Gabby, A Story of Courage and Hope by Gabrielle Giffords and Mark Kelly. All Americans have been following Gabby's incredible and inspiring journey towards recovery. Now, this best-selling book delivers hope and redemption in the face of the tragic shooting and brings us the saga of two unforgettable heroes. Mark Kelly shares the reading with Jeffrey Zaslow.
This time, Gabby entered the beach house being pushed in a wheelchair, wearing a helmet to protect the side of her head where part of her skull was missing. It had been removed during the surgery that saved her life after she was shot. While the others at the house had come in pairs, each astronaut with a spouse, Gabby and I showed up with this whole crazy entourage. Her mother, her chief of staff, a nurse, 3 U.S. Capitol police officers, 3 Kennedy Space Center security officers, and a NASA colleague assigned to look after Gabby for the duration of my mission. The support Gabby now needed was considerable, and certainly not what my fellow crew members expected in their final moments with their wives. Instead of an intimate goodbye and a secluded beach, this became quite the circus. It was a bit embarrassing, but the men of my crew and their spouses were 100% supportive. They understood. Gabby had just logged 16 arduous and painful weeks sequestered in a Tucson hospital and then a Houston rehab center. She had worked incredibly hard, struggling to retrain her brain and fight off depression over her circumstances. For her doctors and security detail to give their blessings and allow her to travel, this was how her coming out needed to be handled. My crewmates and their wives greeted Gabby warmly, and she smiled at all of them and said hello, though it was clear that she was unable to make real small talk. Some words and most sentences were still beyond her. Everyone was positive, but everyone noticed. As I watched Gabby try to navigate the social niceties, I was very proud of her. She had learned since her injury that it could sap her energy and her spirits to be self-conscious about her deficiencies or her appearance. So she had found ways to communicate by employing upbeat hand motions and that terrific smile of hers, the same smile that had helped her connect with constituents, woo political opponents, and get my attention. She didn't need to rattle off sentences to charm a bunch of astronauts and their wives. She just had to tap into the person she's always been. After we settled in at the beach house, I said to Gabby, "Want to go down to the ocean?" "Yes," she said. "Yes, swim in the ocean." Though Gabby grew up in Arizona, a daughter of the desert, she loves the ocean more than anyone I've ever known. She first saw the Pacific as a kid, traveling with her parents and sister through Mexico and Central America. They'd spend weeks at a time, driving up and down the Pacific coast in a station wagon or camper. She loved to swim, to look for shells, to people watch. Later, the Atlantic became equally alluring for her, including this stretch of beach where we walked and swam together before my previous space flights. On those visits, Gabby had enjoyed swimming well offshore. I admired how she engaged the other spouses so they all could shake off their nervousness over the risky missions ahead. She had just the right touch, embracing the duties that came with being the commander's wife, while also being completely down to earth and making everyone feel welcome. But this time, of course, she was dependent on the kindness of others. Her nurse took her into the bathroom and got her into her swimsuit. Though it was a warm day, she needed sweatpants and a jacket, since her injury leaves her cold so much of the time. Gabby helped dress herself the best she could using her left hand, but she was limited. Because she was shot in the left side of her brain, which partially controls the right side of the body, her right hand remained mostly useless and still, an appendage on her lap.
That was Gabby by Gabrielle Giffords and Mark Kelly. James, long among the most admired mystery writers of our time, draws the character of Jane Austen's beloved novel, Pride and Prejudice, into a tale of murder and emotional mayhem. Death comes to Pemberley. It is 1803, 6 years since Elizabeth and Darcy embarked on their life together at Pemberley, Darcy's estate. Their peaceful, orderly world seems almost unassailable. Elizabeth and Darcy have 2 fine sons. Elizabeth's sister Jane and her husband live nearby. Her father visits often. There is talk about the prospects of marriage for Darcy's sister Georgiana, and preparations are underway for their much-anticipated annual ball. Then, on the eve of the ball, the patrician idol is shattered. A coach careens up the drive carrying Lydia, Elizabeth's disgraced sister, who, with her husband, the dubious Wickham, has been banned from Pemberley. She stumbles out of the carriage, hysterical, shrieking that Wickham has been murdered. With shocking suddenness, Pemberley is plunged into a frightening mystery. Inspired by a lifelong passion for Austen, P.D. James masterfully recreates the world of Pride and Prejudice, electrifying it with the excitement of a brilliantly crafted crime story. Rosalind Landor narrates.
She had eloped with Lieutenant George Wickham, an officer in the militia which had been stationed at Meryton, an escapade which was confidently expected to end, as all such adventures deserve, in her desertion by Wickham, banishment from her home, rejection from society, and the final degradation, which decency forbade the ladies to mention. The marriage had, however, taken place, the first news being brought by a neighbour, William Goulding, when he rode past the Longbourn coach, and the newly married Mrs. Wickham placed her hand on the open window so that he could see the ring. Mrs. Bennet's sister, Mrs. Phillips, was assiduous in circulating her version of the elopement, that the couple had been on their way to Gretna Green, but had made a short stop in London to enable Wickham to inform a godmother of his forthcoming nuptials, and on the arrival of Mr. Bennet in search of his daughter, the couple had accepted the family's suggestion that the intended marriage could more conveniently take place in London. No one believed this fabrication, but it was acknowledged that Mrs. Phillips's ingenuity in devising it deserved at least a show of credulity. George Wickham, of course, could never be accepted in Meryton again. To rob the female servants of their virtue and the shopkeepers of their profit. But it was agreed that should his wife come among them, Mrs. Wickham should be afforded the tolerant forbearance previously accorded to Miss Lydia Bennet. There was much speculation about how the belated marriage had been achieved. Mr. Bennet's estate was hardly worth £2,000 a year, and it was commonly felt that Mr. Wickham would have held out for at least £500, and all his Meryton and other bills being paid, before consenting to the marriage. Mrs. Bennet's brother, Mr. Gardiner, must have come up with the money. He was known to be a warm man, but he had a family, and no doubt would expect repayment from Mr. Bennet. There was considerable anxiety in Lucas Lodge that their son-in-law's inheritance might be much diminished by this necessity. But when no trees were felled, no land sold, no servants put off, and the butcher showed no disinclination to provide Mrs. Bennet with her customary weekly order, it was assumed that Mr. Collins and dear Charlotte had nothing to fear, and that as soon as Mr. Bennet was decently buried, Mr. Collins could take possession of the Longbourn estate with every confidence that it had remained intact. But the engagement which followed shortly after Lydia's marriage, that of Miss Bennet and Mr. Bingley of Netherfield Park, was received with approbation. It was hardly unexpected. Mr. Bingley's admiration for Jane had been apparent from their first meeting at an assembly ball. Miss Bennet's beauty, gentleness, and the naive optimism about human nature, which inclined her never to speak ill of anyone, made her a general favourite. But within days of the engagement of her eldest to Mr. Bingley being announced, an even greater triumph for Mrs. Bennet was noised abroad, and was at first received with incredulity. Miss Elizabeth Bennet, the second daughter, was to marry Mr. Darcy, the owner of Pemberley, one of the greatest houses in Derbyshire, and, it was rumoured, with an income of £10,000 a year. It was common knowledge in Meryton that Miss Lizzie hated Mr. Darcy, an emotion in general held by those ladies and gentlemen who had attended the first assembly ball, at which Mr. Darcy had been present with Mr. Bingley and his two sisters, and at which he had given adequate evidence of his pride and arrogant disdain of the company, making it clear, despite the prompting of his friend Mr. Bingley, that no woman present was worthy to be his partner.
That was Death Comes to Pemberley by P.D. James. Sure. Sherlock Holmes is, of course, one of the greatest detectives in literary history. For the first time since the death of Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, a new Holmes story has been sanctioned by his estate, whetting the appetites of fans everywhere. The House of Silk, a Sherlock Holmes novel by best-selling novelist and Holmes expert Anthony Horowitz, brings a compelling atmospheric story to life. With access to the estate's archives and careful study of the original stories, Horowitz weaves a tale that will satisfy new fans and dedicated Baker Street irregulars. The narration by Derek Jacobi is spot on, and readers, it's elementary. You're going to love it.
Indeed, if anyone had suggested that I might be a published writer, I would have laughed at the thought. But I think I can say, in all honesty and without flattering myself, that I have become quite renowned for the way I have chronicled the adventures of the great man, and felt no small sense of honour when I was invited to speak at his memorial service at Westminster Abbey, an invitation which I respectfully declined. Holmes had often sneered at my prose style, and I could not help but feel that had I taken my place at the pulpit, I would have felt him standing at my shoulder, gently mocking whatever I might say from beyond the grave. It was always his belief that I exaggerated his talents and the extraordinary insights of his brilliant mind. He would laugh at the way I would construct my narrative so as to leave to the end a resolution which he swore he had deduced in the opening paragraphs. He accused me more than once of vulgar romanticism, and thought me no better than any Grub Street scribbler. But, generally, I think he was unfair. In all the time that I knew him, I never saw Holmes read a single work of fiction, with the exception, that is, of the worst items of sensational literature. And although I cannot make any great claim for my own powers of description, I am prepared to say that they did the job, and that he himself could have done no better. Indeed, Holmes almost admitted as much when he finally took pen to paper and set out, in his own words, the strange case of Godfrey Emsworth. This episode was presented as The Adventure of the Blanched Soldier, a title which in itself falls short of perfection in my view, for blanching would surely be more appropriate to an almond. I have, as I say, received some recognition for my literary endeavours, but that, of course, was never the point. Through the various twists of fate which I have outlined, I was the one chosen to bring the achievements of the world's foremost consulting detective to light, and presented no fewer than 60 adventures to an enthusiastic public. More valuable to me, though, was my long friendship with the man himself. It is a year since Holmes was found at his home on the Downs, stretched out and still, that great mind forever silenced. When I heard the news, I realized that I had lost not just my closest companion and friend, but, in many ways, the very reason for my existence. 2 marriages, 3 children, 7 grandchildren, a successful career in medicine, and the Order of Merit awarded to me by His Majesty King Edward VII in 1908 might be considered achievement enough for anyone, but not for me. I miss him to this day, and sometimes in my waking moments I fancy that I hear them still, those familiar words. "The game's afoot, Watson." They serve only to remind me that I will never again plunge into the darkness and swirling fog of Baker Street with my trusty service revolver in my hand. I think of Holmes often, waiting for me on the other side of that great shadow which must come to us all. And in truth, I long to join him.
That was The House of Silk by Anthony Horowitz. Readers, thank you so much for spending a bit of your holidays with me. Of course, I wish you and yours a joyful season and hope that some of the magic of these days will follow you throughout the year and on every page you turn. See you next week on The Book Report.